Talk given Friday, 6th October, 1972. We tend to take for granted the statement which we hear right from our young days, that appearances are deceptive. It is necessary that we should look into this statement. If appearances are deceptive, and obviously that means that the appearance, time and again, does not represent the reality. Or that the appearance is itself not reality. Now, is this so? In actual fact, if appearance is not reality, then the two are eternally separate. And if, in addition, appearances are deceptive, then appearance contradicts reality. Reality contradicts appearance. We use the two words, appearance and reality. Which of them is the fact, the truth? Is that which our word reality stands for the truth? Or is that which the word appearance stands for the truth? What is the truth? What is the fact? See, we rarely look into this in depth. Philosophers have written quite a lot about appearance and reality and so forth. They have gone very learnedly into the meaning of the word appearance, the meaning of the word reality, produced tomes about it all, and drawn their own conclusions. And their conclusions have affected human lives throughout the ages. We, the mass of human beings, take for granted that what the great mind, the philosopher, or whoever he is, has said about the matter is the truth, and we must shape our lives in accordance with that statement. We cannot deny that in our everyday life we do experience the fact that the appearance as we see it and the reality as we think the reality is do not tally with each other. And because they do not tally with each other, we say appearances are deceptive. But remember, I, the person, am seeing the appearance. And having seen the appearance, I am interpreting it with my mind. I am the person also who conceives reality with my mind as it is. which means actually that I make a picture of reality. I have an idea, oh, the reality is so and so. Or if I don't make such a positive statement, I say, I believe the reality must be so and so. Or ought to be so and so, perhaps. Now you see, actually, I am the originator of what to me personally, the living person, is the appearance, and what to me is reality. And I, being an ordinary man in the world, there are millions of others like me, and the general consensus seems to be that appearances are deceptive. But I think we could challenge that and see that that statement, as a statement of fact, is not true. Is it not more likely that it is not that the appearance is deceptive, but that I am not seeing truly? If a person, for instance, behaves in a certain way, and I am not really perceptive and understanding, I could easily be deceived as to his motives or intentions or what he is trying to put across to me. But if I am really perceptive, whatever he presents to me externally, for my perception, for my observation, will not deceive me as to the whole fact of what he is and what he is doing. I would know him inside out. In which case, he would be unable to deceive me if he wanted to deceive me. And in the looking at it another way, I, seeing the appearance of his, the external shape of his behavior, his speech, and so forth, would not be deceived. I'd know the whole reality. Think about this very carefully. We say time and again, oh, that awful person, he deceived me. I never say that I, foolish person, could not see truly. And laid myself open to be deceived. Again, it may be that the other person is making no effort whatsoever to deceive me. He is acting in perfect good faith, perfectly honestly, and let us say perfectly rightly. But I, not having the capacity to see truly, get deceived. I imagine all sorts of things which have no relationship to the reality of that person's behavior or action. If the situation was such that I was quite free of all delusion, of all illusion, if I were quite free within myself of all those factors which condition, which spoil my power of perfect observation, If I were free of all that, then under all circumstances I would see truly. And whatsoever appeared to me would be seen by me and understood by me as the actual reality there present. So that the split between appearance and reality is really due to my shortcomings. I am not capable yet of being conscious, of being aware of what actually is in its wholeness, in its truth. And therefore, this confusion, this incapacity in myself produces the disharmonious duality of appearance and reality. Look at another aspect of this. We say, this world is pain and misery and full of difficulties, problems, and so on. But that world is the perfect world, which is all wonderful and happy and beautiful and so forth. Now, supposing it were possible to make a complete record by unimaginably wonderful apparatus and instruments of my conception and perception of this world and yours and yours and yours and so forth for, let us say, a million people, those instruments would all record something different. Although the actual thing is the one thing that is presented to us, the million people. And in the same way, if we could take a record of what each one of us imagines and conceives and believes that world to be, there would be a million different records. You see what I'm getting at? I myself am not whole, complete, integrated, a harmony. This is where the root of conflict, of difficulty, of misery, and so forth lies. I myself am the root, the source of the untruth. And I must wake up to that fact. If I really wake up to that fact, the 1001 instances all through the day, when I'm throwing the blame upon somebody else or upon some circumstance, would vanish. This doesn't mean that if the circumstance is a circumstance where things are in a mess, or one's actual relationship in action with another person or persons is not proceeding harmoniously, it doesn't mean that that will immediately become harmonious and so forth. It will be a painful circumstance. It will be an unpleasant relationship for the time being. But I would not be deceived anywhere if I were free from imperfect perception, unwhole sensitivity. If my sensitivity and perception were whole and complete, then I would be conscious in terms of the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And then you see, we have, as I said a few moments ago, we cease to blame the other person or the circumstance. And if we cease to blame the other person or circumstance, other things also cease. Resentment, depression, the passion to overcome what stands in our way. We would also wake up to the fact that what stands in the way is myself. You see, the sort of total difference this makes to our stance with respect to ourselves and our stance with respect to what we call the not-self, other people, the world, things, and so forth. In other words, relationship which is disharmonious with respect to myself as I am aware of myself, and in connection with other people and things, all that disharmony of relationship would be out. The relationship would be a true relationship. It can be either pleasant or unpleasant, grievous or joyous. That's another matter. But it would be true. It would be the reality. Now, of course, I'm using the word reality in the sense of truth. It would be the actual fact. Now, if any one of us singly can realize that state of being undeceived and sensitively, perceptively be in relation with the whole fact as it is, then we can respond towards the situation or the person in the right way, the true way. And if we can do that, then it is the action which is pure love, unsullied by sentimentality, by emotionalism, by any sort of misconceptions, and all the rest of it. It would be the true thing. And if it is the true thing, it is the creative thing. And this is love which is creative, which is transcendent. Love is the sensitive component of the one thing in which wisdom is the perceptive component. the understanding component. The coolness and the complete steadiness and balance of the perception, the true perception, and the warmth and interaction of the sensitivity are there in a great harmony. But you see, this entails being awake. It entails being awake so purely and so completely that every instant of our awakenedness is full of self-knowledge. We are not deluded with respect to this which we call ourself. We are not deluded. You remember the Buddha's words with respect to himself? He's talking about himself. The Tathagata, he who has gone thus and realized enlightenment, perfection, you see, is a being not liable to delusion. Now, we must never fall into the trap of thinking that the being not liable to delusion is a wonderfully clever man. It's not cleverness. It is this union of love, wisdom. And that functions absolutely freely and perfectly. So he's a being not liable to delusion. I, as I am, to use a phrase which has been used very aptly in certain ways, I, a blind child of mortality, where shall I search out the forces which make for my being in the deluded state? Where else but in the hidden recesses of one's own mind, in the deep well of the psyche? It's a well which is so deep that as we look down into it, its depths are dark, and therefore we cannot see. But keep looking. Keep looking, maintaining calm, unflurried, undesirous to produce a good result particularly, and gradually one's eyes become accustomed to that darkness, and lo and behold, you see through the dark, and you will see the fact through the dark. Because the hidden recesses of the mind will yield up their secret if you will attend to them with a calm, steady, unperturbed gaze, which is the gaze of loving comprehension. And then the deeps of the mind will yield up all sorts of things. The hidden resentments, the vast hordes of hidden, unresolved discords. And God knows we have millions of them stored up in our psyche since we were born. Because you see, the world process in our lives is immensely rich. It is full, absolutely full, of millions of events constantly taking place in the mind and affecting us. But the conscious part of ourselves is unable to be conscious of the whole thing. And in fact, it is a mercy of nature that we cannot be conscious. If we were conscious of everything all the time, we'd be completely overwhelmed. We couldn't possibly survive. The organism, which is the apparatus through which the life force or the life energy works, would be just shattered. Therefore, this very blindness, partial blindness, this darkness, is also our safeguard. You know that Hindu saying, if you want to look directly at the sun, make sure first that your eyes can stand that light, or else you'll be blinded. You see, there are profound meanings to all that. But now look into this deep well, this dark well, and let it yield up its secrets. All these unresolved discords. And if we remain quiet as they come up to consciousness, come up to the surface, that means, of this well, if we remain quiet and see them for exactly what they are, that psychical energy, which is a demon, a power for ill in the dark depths, is changed into an angel, a faculty of one's own soul for harmony, for good, for peace and beauty in the world. Part of this process goes on unconsciously. Life in itself has an extraordinary loving kindness and mercy attached to it. Make no mistake about that. It is there. And life itself does it. Because, never forget, I don't do anything on my own, exclusively on my own. I cannot. I haven't the ability, the power, to do anything exclusively on my own. I'm always the instrument, the vehicle, through which this totality, this omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, this marvelous, incredible, wonderful, blissful, terrible totality which does everything through me. And this totality protects the apparatus, protects the instrument. And only in due time is the instrument worn out and the organism is shattered. And if one has lived rightly, beautifully, and the Lord of Death comes and very gently shuts one's eyes in blissful rest, with no unaccounted for difficulties left over, substrates for rebirth, was the phrase that the Buddha used. Substrates for another conditioned state, which means the state of bondage. We think too much in terms of individual attainment, achievement. We are all the time, in fact, unconsciously thinking and working for individual attainment and achievement, for our salvation. If we are sufficiently proud and condescending, we will take others along with us quite graciously. That is one of the little demons deep down in this dark well. I think militant evangelists should take good note of that. Supposing we can really then awaken in this way. And maintain our peace and calm as all the demons emerge out of the depths of this dark well. Supposing we can do that, what happens to our own consciousness, our own awareness at work? The nature of the awareness I'm talking of now. It undergoes a transformation from this state of divisive, analytical, separative, confused, blinkered, colored, discriminative consciousness into pure awareness. In the state of pure awareness, what the religions have called the omniscience of God functions quite freely. It seems to me this is one of the real meanings of omniscience. If one realizes this state, the imprisonment, the constriction of the functioning of our minds and of the nature of awareness by the pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow, conflicting duality is completely out. In other words, we are free of those two horrible jailers in our lives, attachment and aversion. And if attachment and aversion, craving and violence have gone out of the situation, consciousness, the whole mind, is perfectly clean, pure, sensitive, free. And for such a person, there is no separation between appearance and reality. The two are an identity. If you can understand this, still better if we can go through moments when we actually experience it, then we shall really know the truth of that great statement in Mahayana Buddhism, for instance, that nirvana and samsara are an identity. You see, we use phrases like that and bandy them about very cleverly. It is so impressive, you know, to see a great audience. The great open faces, not the great open spaces, looking up, you know, astonished, with great admiration to the eloquent speaker who expounds the identity of nirvana and samsara. That's all cobweb making, intellectual cobweb making. It's a necessary step in the process. First you've got to make your cobwebs, get caught in them, feel their discomfort, and then you get rid of the cobwebs. All that is just cobweb making. The experiencing of this, the realization of it, is a case of the living of the religious life. And the living of the religious life means fundamentally always the moralities. Every moment of my life, as I experience it, am I reacting in terms of violence or am I truly harmless? Am I reacting in terms of possessiveness, greed, or am I free from that? Am I reacting in terms of attachment or aversion? In terms of the inflaming of ambitions in me and so forth? Or am I really free of all that? This is the living of a religious life. This is the watching that Jesus talked of. Watch and pray. For ye know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh. The Son of Man, the Son of Mind. And this mind is not my mind or your mind or a postulated universal mind, but mind in the sense in which, for instance, Hermes Trismegistus talks, and God, All Father Mind. You and I have this potentiality within us. It's that unknown, mysterious, all-father mind which is the omnipotent power which is just coming to life and into perfect manifestation through each one of the instruments which that creative energy produces. And those instruments are you and I, the living beings. You see how marvelous man's destiny is. How utterly beautiful it is. Its beauty, its truth, its marvel is so immense, so wonderful, that when one really begins to glimpse it, even a fraction of it, a fragment of it, one has ceased to get excited about it. Because the excitement is always self-oriented. Its roots are in the longing for pleasure. Sensuality in any shape and form. And since we have just suddenly mentioned this word, sensuality, see how easily the profundity of the teaching about refraining from all sensuality is misunderstood by the mob. And therefore they misinterpreting it, they misapply it in terms of the repression of the senses and the sense functions. So you see, the zest of life, the true joy of life, goes out of the person who is playing at living the religious life. To live the religious life is like the work of a man who is born with a certain gift. Let us say he's a painter. He's an artist. And you know how the whole of him will be completely dedicated to the release of perfect beauty on the canvas with his brush. And in that complete self-dedication, if it is true self-dedication, there is no separate self-consciousness involved in it. There is no isolative self-consciousness. The painting and himself, I'm talking as the other party, just looking on objectively, are one and the same thing. I'm no artist myself. My interest has been the piano particularly. I have watched in the last 50 years and more in this country, I have watched hundreds of performances by pianists on the platform. And the great performances was a marvelous experience in so many ways, but this is the way that I want you to consider. You look at that man or woman, whoever it is, sitting at that piano and playing it. You know, you suddenly see that the man and the piano are not two things. There is only the man piano. They are a unity in the most marvelous way. It is as if that gigantic concert grand, and it's 9 feet long, you know, a concert grand, is an extension of this man. And I've watched it with a violinist too. And I mention a violinist because the violin is a charming little instrument in size as compared with this great big gigantic instrument. And it's just the same. That violin and that man are one unity. So you see, this separative self-consciousness is out. It is not that he has lost himself. It is not that he has found himself. The losing and finding are always a self-directed, a self-oriented thing. None of those are there. There is the complete harmony, the oneness. Now, if my own awareness, my own mind is whole and pure and so forth, then appearance and reality are an identity, just exactly as nirvana and samsara are an identity. What is one of the extraordinary things that you will notice then? In your actual daily life, you will see so truly from moment to moment what is happening that you will never obstruct the life process. If I really see that way and really understand that way, I will no longer be a dark shadow in the light of God. there will be only pure light. Because there will be no obstructive eye present to be a shadow. There will only be God. The totality. Unbesmirched. It is I, a man, who have the power to realize this, or, as is ordinarily the case in the world and has been for thousands of millennia, I can besmirch the situation. Because it is the peculiarity of the human species that it can look within and be separatively conscious of itself in relation to a without, and exercise choice for and against. I alone can do that. My cat can't exercise choice that way. If a bigger cat comes and traps and stalks it or something, it runs up a tree and it is there. And it just waits until this cat is out of the way and it will come down. There's no choice involved. It cannot choose. It just naturally obeys the laws of its being. But you and I can choose. You and I can exercise, can exert an act which has been deliberately chosen by us. We have it in us to do that. When there is harmony, one's whole awareness is choiceless. That is to say, it doesn't exercise particular choice. That is the meaning of choiceless awareness. It doesn't exercise particular choice. Particular choice is always self-oriented. The choice which obstructs the life process as a whole. The choice which obtrudes self as a separate something upon totality. But you see, that obtrusion may succeed for a time, as we fondly imagine, but in the end, that obtruding thing meets death, complete disruption. Alexander, Napoleon, the whole host of them . They obtruded the self upon the world stage up to a point. What looked like success and then disaster. Death, the wages of sin. Not death, which is the perfect consummation of truth and love and beauty. That we can change this by allowing totality to work through us. Don't choose to be the cooperator of totality. I'll use the word God instead of totality. If God chooses me, that is the meaning of the chosen person. It's not a personal choice. It's not a separative choice. It is that which inevitably happens in the course of the universal process. In that way, there is the release of wholeness, of holiness. And in any one person through whom that release becomes manifest, there is a great light which spreads over the whole environment, and the environment knows it not consciously. But we are all human beings in that environment are concerned. Their psyche is affected for good. We are helped by each other without our knowing it. If we woke up to these things, we can truly love one another. Remember last Sunday, I said a few words about loving one another. As the parent and child, as the husband and wife, as the friend and friend, as brother and sister, and so forth, in whatsoever relationship there may be. Love one another. And remember that the appropriateness of the expression of that love is of fundamental importance. This is where we make our mistakes all the time, don't we? This is where we don't love sanely, we love madly. Oh, I'm madly in love. And yes, look at the tragedies that follow the madness of love. That sort of madness, the real madness. The destructiveness of passion. Whatever way that passion may express itself. But the love, which is true love, will always express itself in the appropriate form. Because the reality and the appearance will have no difference between them.